Once upon a time, there was a cotton trail from Duncan to Ardmore. It went into Ardmore near the standpipe. It went through or by Prairie Valley, Enterprise, Newport, Sneed, Wheeler, Graham, Fox, and other places to Duncan. There were no large creeks to cross and no bridges, according to a letter from James Steele to Mac McGalliard and reported in his reporter's notebook column. All of the cotton was hauled from Duncan to Ardmore until the Rock Island Railroad was built to Duncan. Ardmore was the inland cotton market for many years. The Santa Fe Railroad was built to Ardmore in 1887 and 1888. The farmers and freighters drove their teams and wagons loaded with the big bales of cotton to Ardmore. The teams and wagons were put in a wagon yard. The farmer and his cotton money were soon parted if he took too much liquid celebration and mixed with the wrong kind of people. The virgin land produced cotton and other crops almost beyond imagining today, and the native grasses produced cattle by the hundreds and thousands. Once upon a time, there was a big old home on 3rd Avenue Northeast, just outside of the city limits, where Felix and Callie Boyd King reared 9 children and operated one of Ardmore's first dairy farms. The big 3-story home was built by the Kings in 1905 and had a total of 22 rooms. They moved out in 1942 and the home was used as a nursing home for the elderly. Before moving to Ardmore, Felix King was a druggist at Berwyn, now Gene Autry. Mrs. King was the daughter of the Boyd, who was a partner of a man named Love, who operated the Boyd and Love Oil Springs Health Resort, first northeast of Marietta, and then at the springs on Oil Creek, which are now on the Goddard Ranch northeast of Gene Autry. This information is from the Ardmore Public Library from files donated by Mac McGalliard of his reporter's notebook columns. There is such a wealth of interesting information that I would encourage any of you history enthusiasts to spend some time there reading them in their entirety. There's a big cave located southwest of Turner Falls, which has about 3 miles of passageways, a waterfall, and a huge snowbank of calcite in it. Sounds kind of eerie, doesn't it? It was named for Ethel Hinman, a real girl who lived in the Arbuckles back of Turner Falls. She may have been wild in a sense of daring, but nothing crazy. They had a drought in the mountains and ran out of water. They knew there was water here and there under the Arbuckles. They thought the big cave might provide clues. But the then only known entrance was a deep, vertical hole that no one had dared to descend into. Ethel Hinman volunteered and climbed down the sheer walls. She found water and checked the distance and direction. She climbed out of the cave and showed the men where to dig on the surface. They got plenty of water, installed a windmill, and used the well for many, many years. Someone said, "Ethel Hinman sure is a wild woman," and the cave became Wild Woman Cave. The last the Springer people heard of her, she went to Hollywood to be a stunt woman in the movies. This was part of a letter written March the 1st, 1935, by F.S. Douglas of Sulphur to Dr. Lyman C. Veazey. It told of an incident involving Dutch George, who had a restaurant across the railroad tracks. Dr. Hardy, pioneer physician who established Ardmore's first hospital, John Easley, pioneer publisher of the Daily Ardmoreite, and Mr. Douglas heard shots and learned some cowboys were shooting up George's restaurant, a common pastime in those days. He came running up to us and in his broken German explained that the cowboy shot his hole full of stovepipes. Dr. Hardy asked him how much money was in the cash drawer. He said about $3. The doctor told him to go back and protect his property and that if he got shot to send for him and he would be pleased to help him. I noticed how he emphasized the pleased. Easley went up Caddo Street to hunt a lead pencil. I guess he thought he would soon have a story. This is the second part of the story I told you yesterday about the cowboys shooting up Dutch George's place and was part of a letter written in 1935 to Dr. Lyman Veazey from F.S. Douglas. Mr. Douglas said he drifted up to Mike Gorman's furniture store and undertaking shop to tell Mike to prepare for a job. He said, "I guess I thought that between the cowboys and the doctor, Dutch George might need Mike." Most of the coffins were made in those days by carpenters for undertakers. They looked at the subject, estimated his length and weight, and made it to order. Mike used bright, shining handles. They were usually put on after the body was put in the coffin, and they turned black as soon as you touched them. For that reason, the pallbearers wore white cotton gloves that cost 10 cents, or three pairs for 25 cents. Jake Hammond, an ingenious man, arrived in New York City in the spring of 1913, looking for someone with money to finance his dream. He soon managed to locate himself in the bar of the old Waldorf Hotel, right in the midst of the greatest financial wizards in America. Hammond hoped to find one with patience to listen and to follow him to southern Oklahoma to build a railroad, and he found his man, Circus King John Ringling. Traveling the rails with the Ringling Brothers Circus, he had become intensely interested in the industry. Their dream was to develop the cattle land west of Ardmore. Construction began. The first rails had just been laid when an unexpected bonanza was discovered. J.M. Critchlow of Titusville, Pennsylvania, brought in a gusher on the farm of Wirt Franklin less than 10 miles from the railroad right-of-way. Ringling sent his attorney, John M. Kelly, to Oklahoma to buy as much oil property as he could. He, along with Hammond's help, managed to purchase some 8,000 acres of oil-rich leases. The Ringling Railroad carried the roustabouts, roughnecks, and tons of equipment necessary to develop a new oil field as far as the end of the tracks. Eastern lines began to abandon their wooden coaches. John Ringling purchased many of these, and these plush and richly upholstered coaches were used to transport the roustabouts and roughnecks. Quarters along the work line for the section hands and commissary were outdated cars from the Ringling Brothers Circus special train equipment. One of the construction camps along the railroad was named in honor of Ringling's secretary, Charles Wilson. Oil field suppliers set up their shop at this budding community. Wilson became the principal supply point for the oil rush. The new oil field grew to be the largest in the world at that time. Ringling, bustling with activity and bursting with excitement, became an oil boom town. At the height of the oil rush, as many as 1,500 freight teams operated from Ringling. The Gene Autry area was settled about 100 years ago by Indians and Negro families, and the Washita River bottoms, where the industrial airpark and ranches are now located, was covered by forest. In the late 1870s, C.C. Henderson built a store at a ford on the Washita. The town has had five names. First, Henderson's Store. Then in July 1883, a post office was obtained, and Henderson named the place Lou for his wife. The Postal Department didn't like this for a name, and on November the 22nd, 1883, the name was changed to Dresden. Dresden was located in the Washita Bottoms near the northeast corner of the present air park, and a big flood on the river nearly washed it away. They moved to town to the hillside where it now stands. When the Santa Fe Railroad was built through here in 1887, Dresden was changed to Berwyn by railroad officials. The name Berwyn was changed to Gene Autry in 1942 after the Western singer and movie star of this name bought a ranch near the town. What was it like in the good old days in Ardmore when life was supposed to have been simpler? Ardmore at that time had no city government, no water or sewer system, and no police or fire department. The Board of Trade, which later became the Ardmore Chamber of Commerce, was the only civic organization. In the November the 16th, 1983 issue of the Daily Ardmoreite, the editor cited the following needs: a good live volunteer fire department with a hook and ladder truck and bucket equipment for a bucket brigade; a sewer from the corner of the Hardy Building on Main Street to the culvert on Caddo, by which that unsightly mud hole, which is a terror alike to the dudes' hats and the ladies' dresses, can be drained. The merchants should hang their signs so a man of average height can manage a stroll without having his brains knocked out. Someone empowered to keep open passage on the streets through which ladies and farmers can drive without an escort or a bodyguard. This is just a glance at our town in 1893, a town of 4,000 people 6 years after its founding in 1887. Once upon a time, John J. Chapman was the doctor at Poolville, formerly Elk and Indian Territory days. After serving in the Army as a medical officer at Fort Sill, he bought a good horse and saddle and rode east to the little town of Elk, where he established his first practice. His patients were farmers, ranchers, Indians with head rights, and Negroes who had been granted 40 acres of land. The town consisted of two general stores, two gins, a saloon, and a hotel. The tall bachelor doctor, speaking in a clipped English accent, was soon being wined and dined by all the mothers with eligible daughters. But a professional call to the home of John Williams and an introduction to the youngest daughter, Ollie, soon ended in their marriage in 1895. The doctor was paid for his practice with produce, cattle, and horses, and soon had a ranch of 2,000 cattle in the Arbuckle Mountains. In 1903, he opened a drugstore in Elk, and Mrs. Chapman became the first woman registered pharmacist when Oklahoma became a state in 1907. Once upon a time, according to legend, four outlaws robbed a train near Greenville between Ardmore and Marietta and got $50,000 in gold that was being shipped from Indian Territory banks to Dallas. This was long before the lake was built, and they holed up at the Tucker Tower Point, where there was a large cave inside the cliff that made a good hideout. A posse surrounded them, and three of the outlaws were killed, and the fourth was captured and sent to the penitentiary for a long time. The $50,000 in gold was never found. The surviving outlaw never got the chance to return for the loot. An old-timer who worked on the building of Lake Murray says he and others who knew the story of the robbery searched for the loot while they were working around the Tucker Tower Point. They found $1,500 in silver hidden in the cave. Divers have dived for it, but the gold is still down there somewhere around Tucker Tower, and the legend goes on, based on the undying lure of buried gold. Mac McGalliard talked to Ab Jolly, a longtime Ardmoreite who was reared at Woodford in the early days. Ab asked, "Do you remember when there weren't any grades? You were classified in the first reader, second reader, third reader, and so on. When you finished one book, you were promoted to the next book instead of from one grade to another. The old two-room schools had grades 1 through 5 in the little room, and grades 6 through 8 were all in the big room. I don't remember about those days firsthand, but I've heard a lot about them." He added that the town of Woodford was named for Woods Ford, a crossing on Hickory Creek about where State Highway 53 Bridge is now located, named for an early settler at that point. And there was once a little town of Otterville on Hickory Creek, southwest of Woodford. Ab also reported there was a settlement at the old asphalt mines, 1 mile south and 3/4 mile east of Woodford, once upon a time.